and keeps talking over them, incoherently rambling on and on about nothing in particular. So in this situation, who is maundering and who is engaged in badinage? Answer, the two people playfully bantering back and forth are engaged in badinage. The oblivious one is maundering. Situation 3. A criminal who not only robbed a bank for millions, but actually stole candy from a baby as he ran to the getaway car, is caught. Now, as you can imagine, during the ensuing trial, he's criticized harshly and exposed to public abuse and scorn in the press. Is this an example of the word pillory or an example of the word peon? Answer, pillory. Pillory means to expose someone to public abuse and scorn, ridicule. A peon is the opposite, enthusiastic praise for someone or something. We're now moving on to my favorite part, our last section of today's lecture, words that describe nonsense. Whether we hear this nonsense on a talk radio show, during a TV interview, or at the office, English has a ton of words to describe all the poppycock, rubbish, sham, and hokum we deal with in our lives. Now, my wife's late grandfather, known affectionately in our family as Gop, had a wonderful word for speech that was full of hot air and nonsense. He termed it junky junk. And whenever he heard someone spouting off, he'd shake his head, vigorously waving his hand, middle finger pointed in the air, exclaiming with conviction, "That's junky junk." So junky junk has become a catchphrase in our family for verbal nonsense. Let's discuss some other great vocabulary to describe this junky junk. For our first nonsense word, think back to a time you've heard a pretentious, overblown political speech. The particular politician making the speech is a bloviating blowhard. He's trying to trick you into applauding for him with lofty, highfalutin language and bombast. But you're not fooled, and neither is anyone else in the crowd. Nobody's clapping. English has one of my top 10 favorite words to describe this type of contrived and empty talk, claptrap. Claptrap is a noun meaning pretentious nonsense, insincere speech. Originally, and more specifically, claptrap meant and can still mean speech or any artifice through which someone is trying to trap you into clapping for them. Get it? What a great compound word. It's short, punchy, and says what it means. And it's a handy word to use the next time you encounter any pretentious hooey. I love this underused word. So in your vocabulary notebook, you might sketch a picture of two hands with an X across them to show that you're not going to be trapped into clapping by claptrap. Now, not surprisingly, claptrap's often used to describe political speeches, but it's not restricted to politics alone. You might hear claptrap at work from your boss or at a neighborhood get-together from the local blowhard. Don't buy it. Let's put claptrap into context. His fiery speech may have riled up his base supporters for the primary, but it was really just a bunch of partisan claptrap that won't play well in the general election. Now, how many synonyms do you think English has for claptrap? 5? 10? Do I hear 15 or 20? Try 40. That's right, I found at least 40 wonderful, lively, snappy words to describe nonsense. Ready to hear some of them? Okay, here we go. Sham, tripe, tosh, bosh, humbug, poppycock, balderdash, blarney, bombast from a previous lecture, babble, blather, twaddle, hokum, soft soap, prattle, drivel, rubbish, gibberish, jibber jabber, made famous and possibly coined by Mr. T in his memorable quote from the 80s, "Don't give me no jibber jabber," jive, hot air, baloney, horse feathers, and some of my favorite synonyms for nonsense and claptrap, mumbo jumbo, codswallop, malarkey, moonshine, double talk, rigmarole, hogwash, hooey, and tommy rot. 40 synonyms for one basic concept. This just goes to show how much claptrap English speakers have had to put up with over the years. And to answer the question from the beginning of the lecture, yes, claptrap is contagious. I mean, have you ever heard a bunch of bloviating blowhards get together and start talking with each other? Bunk, our next target word, is another noun that means foolish, untrue talk. Nonsense. Bunk's also a toponym, a word named after a place. And it's got a fantastic story behind it. Buncombe, B-U-N-C-O-M-B-E, is a county in North Carolina that was represented in 1820 by a congressman named Felix Walker. Now, as Walker was making a long-winded speech that just wouldn't end, his fellow congressman called for him to sit down, but he refused, saying he was not speaking to the House. He was speaking to the voters in Buncombe. He wanted a speech to print in the papers back home to prove to his constituents that he was doing something. Since Walker's speech was long on windbagging and short on substance, Buncombe, with a change in spelling from the place name, became a term for lofty political mumbo-jumbo. Buncombe, B-U-N-K-U-M, was later shortened to bunk. And we can add the prefix D-E, a prefix indicating negation, to bunk to get debunk, meaning to negate or literally get rid of the bunk, or to expose pretentious nonsense and lies. Debunk, another great word. So, claptrap and bunk. Two great words for nonsense and two of my favorite, short, hard-hitting words in English. Try them at home. You won't be sorry. For our next target word, palaver, I think of the buzz of conversation in the 5 to 10 minutes before I'm getting ready to start my class. My college students are sitting in their seats, chattering away, waiting for me to begin. Often they're talking about everything and anything, but nothing really serious. From last night's party, to what they're going to do after class, to how tired they are, a favorite topic of my 8 a.m. classes. My students are engaged in palaver, which is a noun meaning profuse and idle chit-chat, chatter, empty talk, nonsense. Bunk, our previous target word, is a close synonym for palaver. Now, palaver can also be used to refer to flattery and sweet talk used in an attempt to persuade. Let's put palaver in context. The hard-nosed negotiator cut right through the political palaver and sussed out the important issues and critical policies that separated the two countries. Again, to help you remember palaver, think of a connection to your own life. Think of a time you've heard or been engaged in idle chit-chat about nothing important, just meaningless chatter. Perhaps you were making small talk with your neighbor over the back fence. Write this connection down in your vocabulary notebook. Okay, after claptrap, bunk, and palaver, we arrive at our final nonsense word, the wonderfully visual pablum. Now, pablum is a noun referring to trite, insipid, or simplistic writing, speech, or conceptualization. Originally, pablum was the trademark name for a soft, bland, mushy, easy-to-digest cereal developed for infants and invalid people in the 1930s. And it's now used in a figurative sense to refer to soft, bland, mushy ideas and talk. From cereal for kids to ideas and talk. I mean, don't you just love English? Pablum was derived from a related word you may know, pabulum, which can refer to a nourishing substance or insipid intellectual nourishment. So, if you hear someone spewing forth empty ideas that are just a bunch of bunk and codswallop, or read something that's oversimplified, trite, naive, or without any substance, you've just swallowed some pablum. And try to find something with a bit more substance next time. A wonderful synonym for pablum is pap. Like pablum, pap also originally referred to soft food for infants, and now is used to refer to an oversimplified idea or something lacking in substance, as in, that white paper from the think tank is really just intellectual pap. So to remember pablum, draw a picture of a spoon and a carton with the trademark pablum on it, and the words soft, bland, mushy, and easy to digest next to the word in your vocabulary notebook. This will help you remember that pablum refers to soft, bland, mushy ideas that someone's trying to get you to digest. Okay, let's review our final four words. Claptrap, bunk, palaver, and pablum. I'll give you a few clues and you provide the word. Okay, number one. This nonsense word is a toponym from the name of a county in North Carolina, and that refers to empty talk. Answer, bunk, from Buncombe, North Carolina, and the long-winded, self-serving speech from a congressman representing that county. Okay, number two. This nonsense word can refer to empty, pretentious, political windbagging that attempts to trick you into applauding. Answer, claptrap attempts to trap you into clapping. Number three. This word originally referred to a soft, mushy, easy-to-digest children's cereal, and now refers to soft, mushy, empty ideas and talk. Answer, pablum. Number four. This word means incessant chit-chat, idle chatter. Answer, palaver. All right, let's end today's lecture with three powerful roots that center on the meaning of speak. I'll discuss the meaning of each root and briefly review English words derived from these roots. You might want to record these roots and their derived English words in the same section of your notebook devoted to other speech words that we've been exploring in the past two lectures. Now, we're not going to spend as much time on these derived words as we did on each target word, because you're probably already familiar with many of them. However, being aware of these three Latin roots will help you make connections among words and learn new, unfamiliar words in the future. Our first root is one that we've already touched on in a previous lecture, the Latin root usually spelled as L-O-C or L-O-Q, meaning speak. Now, if you remember, our keyword for this root is ventriloquist. Note the L-O-Q in the middle of ventriloquist. What does a ventriloquist do? A ventriloquist makes it appear as if a dummy is speaking on its own. We also explored other words that share this root, including soliloquy, loquacious, and our target word, obloquy, harshly critical speech. Let's cover a few more words derived from this same root. And as I read these words, notice how they all include the L-O-C or L-O-Q root and share the core meaning of speak. Elocution, the art of public speaking. Eloquent, characterized by fluency and persuasiveness of speech or writing. Colloquium, a conference, usually academic, at which specialists and experts speak on related topics and answer questions. Colloquial, speaking in an informal way. Grandiloquent, an adjective describing overblown, highfalutin, bombastic speech. And interlocutor. Now, inter means between. So one definition of an interlocutor, a noun, is someone who takes part in a conversation or dialogue between people. But you'll often see interlocutor used in its political sense, where it refers to someone who may not necessarily have formal authority to speak on behalf of a group or country, but who serves as a sort of informal middleman who can relay and communicate ideas and information between two groups or countries, sometimes as a prelude to formal negotiations. The interlocutor, while not part of the formal negotiating team, was instrumental in brokering a peace between the two belligerent nations. That's 10 rich vocabulary words from one root. You can see why we say when you learn one word, you actually learn 10. Because one root can be the key to unlock the meanings of scores of words. I'll go through these next two roots more quickly, because they are probably more familiar words. Our second root is D-I-C or D-I-C-T, also meaning speak. English words derived from this root include our keyword diction, dictate, dictionary, predict, verdict, benediction, an expression of good wishes, literally good speech, edict, and indict. And our third root is one we touched on in a previous lecture, VOC, meaning call. English words derived from this root include our keyword vocal, vociferous, calling or crying out vehemently or noisily, advocate, avocation, convocation, invocation, and equivocal, one of our target words literally meaning equal voices, used to mean deliberately ambiguous or open to two or more interpretations. Now, knowledge of a few powerful roots like this is an important part of building a great vocabulary. When you're familiar with a root, a little goes a long way. Well, that concludes our lectures on words relating to all kinds of speech. From laconic to philippic to badinage, you've now got a host of powerful words to describe speech that's playful, that's rambling, and that's harshly critical. Try one of these words out, and just make sure it doesn't come out as claptrap or bunk.
Lecture 17, Eponyms from Literature and History.
Have you ever wanted something to be named after you? Something to carry your legacy on to future generations? If so, English has the perfect word for you, eponym. Eponyms are words named after people. In fact, the Greek prefix ep or epi means on or upon, and the suffix onym means name. So an eponym is a word built upon someone's name. Now, we've already encountered some eponyms in our previous lectures. You'll remember that bowdlerize, to expurgate a text, comes from Thomas Bowdler. And Jeremiad, a bitter lamentation, comes from the prophet Jeremiah in the Bible. Now, English is replete with a host of other lively eponyms, such as bloomers, sideburns, and even sandwich. Now, bloomers were named after the 19th century American women's rights advocate, Amelia Bloomer. Although she didn't create these pants for women, she did promote and popularize them in her newspaper. As for the word sideburns, it comes from the Union Civil War general, Ambrose Burnside, known for his unusually thick whiskers on the sides of his face, which were connected by a mustache, but left his chin clean-shaven. Probably because his whiskers were located on the sides of his face, the general's name, Burnside, was flipped to create sideburns, the term that we use for these mutton chops today. And how can we ever forget that mainstay of lunch and late-night snacking, the sandwich? Now, sandwich comes from the 4th Earl of Sandwich, an English lord. According to one contested but wonderfully vivid account, Lord Sandwich loved to gamble. Not wanting to leave the card table long enough to eat a formal meal, he asked his servants to bring him slices of meat held between two pieces of bread. His friends, apparently getting hungry watching the Earl eat, ordered the same as Sandwich. Now, to become an eponym, a true eponym, like sandwich and sideburns, a word has to acquire its own meaning independent of the original story behind the word. When this happens, most language users aren't aware of the person behind the word. So when I say sandwich, most people start salivating and visualize a turkey club, not a hard-gambling English earl. So today, I'm going to share the people and stories behind 8 excellent eponyms. For our first eponym, let's go back to ancient Greece to meet an Athenian legislator named Draco. Now, Draco lived in the 7th century BCE. a time when justice was capricious in Athens. It was largely carried out according to oral law, with personal vendettas and blood feuds the deciding factors in determining both guilt and punishment. If someone in your family was killed, it was up to your family, not the state, to seek justice. Sounds a little bit like the Wild West, doesn't it? And things got so bad, there was fear that the common Athenians would rebel. So, Draco set out to reform inequities in the criminal justice system. Now, to do this, he set forth what was probably Athens' first comprehensive code of written laws, circa 621 BCE. For each crime, his code mandated a particular penalty. Now, Draco was a pretty consistent sort of guy. If you intentionally murdered someone, guess what you got? That's right, the death penalty. So we've got an eye for an eye, Old Testament type of justice going on, right? Not so fast. If you stole a cabbage in the market, guess what you got? You guessed it again, the death penalty. Now we've got a cabbage for your life kind of justice system. Ouch, that's pretty harsh. For Draco, all criminal offenses, regardless of their severity, deserved the death penalty. So when asked to explain his rationale behind this one-size-fits-all justice system, Draco's reasoning was chilling. Small crimes deserve death. And for great crimes, I know of no penalty severer. How can you argue with that kind of logic? So as you can well imagine, the harshness of Draco's laws became legendary and led to the coining of the term draconian, our first eponym. Draconian is an adjective meaning exceedingly harsh, very severe, cruel. You'll often see draconian used to refer to particularly severe or harsh laws, rules, measures, or people. Here's an example. The dictator's draconian punishment for the rebels was swift and harsh. All those captured were immediately put to death. Now, thankfully for the Athenians, Draco's laws didn't last forever. Solon, a later Athenian statesman, repealed almost all of Draco's laws around 594 BCE. However, Solon was wise enough to keep Draco's homicide law, which made the state, not the family, responsible for justice and murder. So, Draco wasn't all bad. And English got another eponym out of the deal. Solon has come into English as a noun referring to a wise and skilled lawgiver. But our story about Draco doesn't stop with his laws. Draco may have died in a very, shall we say, odd way. Now, among the ancient Greeks, it was traditional to show public approval and adulation by showering the individual, not with applause, but with hats and cloaks. However, according to one tradition, there were so many hats and cloaks thrown on Draco that he was smothered to death. Adulation, yeah, right. You've got to wonder if some of those folks showering him with hats and cloaks had a brother or a sister who had stolen cabbage and paid the price for it. Gives a whole new meaning to killing you with kindness, doesn't it? Now for our next eponym, ask yourself this. Have you ever gotten a wild hair? Had an almost overpowering urge to do something completely crazy? Maybe you were looking out the office window at work and suddenly just wanted to chuck it all, the house, the mortgage, that lawn you have to mow every week, and jump into your classic 1969 green Mustang and hit the open road. Live a carefree life, just moving from place to place. No responsibilities, no deadlines, no schedules. If you've ever felt like this, then you've had a quixotic impulse. Quixotic, an adjective, is a wonderfully useful word to describe anything that's foolishly impractical or romantically impulsive. If you're pursuing some high-minded, idealistic goal that's just foolishly impractical, that you have no chance of actually achieving, you're being quixotic. Let's put quixotic in context. Their quixotic attempt to run a mom-and-pop general store in this era of multinational big box stores was doomed from the start. Now, Quixotic is named after Don Quixote, the main character in a Spanish novel written by Miguel de Cervantes in the early 1600s. The novel is fully titled The Ingenious Gentleman Don Quixote of La Mancha, and is considered by many to be one of the greatest works of literature ever written. Now, as many of you know, the novel follows the adventures of a retired country gentleman who is so profoundly influenced by reading books of chivalry that he decides to sally forth as a knight-errant to right wrongs, save fair maidens, and generally uphold the knight's code. With a distorted perception of reality and a romantic view of the world, he renames himself Don Quixote and dubs his skinny horse Rocinante and takes on his neighbor, Sancho Panza, as his squire, and among many other adventures, attacks windmills that he mistakenly takes for giants. So connecting the character Don Quixote to Quixotic is probably the best way to remember this word. Also, make a personal connection. Think of a time that you've had a wild hair, a time you did something completely crazy, a bit romantic, or totally impractical. Maybe you went on an ill-advised road trip at the last minute, or bought something that you really couldn't afford. Write this experience down in your vocabulary notebook next to Quixotic. For our next eponym, I want you to evaluate this politician's resume. Signer of the Declaration of Independence, Delegate to the Second Continental Congress, Vice President of the United States under James Madison, and Governor of Massachusetts. Pretty impressive, huh? Now, if you had achieved all of this, you'd think history would remember you best for these accomplishments. But not Elbridge Gerry. Even though he did all of these things, he's best known today for a specific type of political skullduggery that is still used and is still controversial today. During his second term as governor of Massachusetts, Elbridge Gerry's administration introduced a bill in 1812 that would redraw the state's congressional election districts to benefit Gerry's Democratic Republican Party. Sound familiar? I mean, some things never change, right? Well, this was certainly not the first time a political party would use redistricting for political advantage. It was so blatant that it was noted by the opposition Federalist Party during the campaign. In fact, the redrawn map of Essex County, Gerry's home territory, was shown at a Federalist Party meeting. Noticing how oddly shaped the newly drawn district looked, one of the Federalists drew, on the map itself, a serpent-shaped creature with claws and wings to outline the crazily shaped district, proclaiming, "That will do for a salamander." And according to one account, another party member at the meeting quipped, "Gerrymander." Now, I want you to notice how this newly coined word, gerrymander, is both an eponym and a portmanteau word. Now, remember that a portmanteau word is a combination of two or more unrelated word parts. And, of course, gerrymander is a combination of Gerry, or Gerry, a person's name, and salamander. Pretty cool. Gerrymander gives us word nerds a twofer. And notice how the hard G in Gerry's name changed to a soft G in gerrymander as the term acquired its own meaning, independent of an association with the Massachusetts governor. Now, the caricature of the salamander-like political district was reproduced as a political cartoon, lampooning Gerry alongside the newly coined term. And with this, the word gerrymander spread incredibly quickly. Now, we still use gerrymander today as a noun referring to the act of dividing election districts to give one party an unfair advantage. Gerrymander can also be used as a verb meaning to divide election districts unfairly. So, did Gerry's gerrymandering work? Absolutely. Despite a popular vote that was nearly a tie, the Democratic Republicans won 29 Senate seats to just 11 for the Federalists. It's no wonder that the word gerrymander and the political double dealing that it refers to is still used today. For our next eponym, we're moving on from political shenanigans to betraying your country. Now, when I say traitor, what names pop into your mind? Judas Iscariot? Benedict Arnold? Well, what about Vidkun Quisling? Since World War II, Quisling's name has become a synonym for traitor. Born in 1887, Quisling was a Norwegian army officer and politician. In 1933, he became the leader of Norway's fascist party. And in 1939, he actually met with Adolf Hitler, asking him to invade and occupy Norway. Quisling hoped that, with German support, he would be able to personally lead a new Norwegian government. Now, as you know, Germany did invade Norway in April 1940. And during this invasion, Quisling asked his fellow Norwegians not to resist, and then proclaimed himself head of Norway's new government. However, Quisling didn't last long as prime minister, only a week. There was such vehement and widespread opposition among Norwegians to Quisling's German-supported power grab that even the Germans themselves withdrew their support from Quisling. However, this wasn't the end for the Norwegian traitor. The Germans set up a puppet government during their occupation of Norway, in which Quisling went on to serve as a figurehead. And in this role, Quisling tried to force-feed National Socialism to Norwegian churches and schools. Heavy-handed tactics like these further embittered his fellow Norwegians. Because of all this, Quisling immediately became known far and wide as a traitor. And according to the Oxford English Dictionary, it was the London Times on April 15, 1940, that first used the term Quisling as a synonym for traitor, reporting that there should be unremitting vigilance also against possible Quislings inside the country. Now, this article opened the floodgates for this newly coined word. The term Quisling spread like wildfire. Within just a month, Quisling was used by the great CBS News correspondent Edward R. Murrow, and it can also be found in the wartime writings of Winston Churchill, George Orwell, and C.S. Lewis. People even started using Quisling as an adjective, as in Quisling newspapers and Quisling governments. And today, Quisling is a noun referring to a traitor who aids an invading and/or occupying enemy force, often serving later in the puppet government. So if you're a Quisling, you're a traitor and a collaborator. So why did this particular word catch on so fast and so universally? Well, why do some words catch on and others don't? Well, perhaps it was a combination of factors. First, there was the historical context. Such strong feelings from so many focused against one person certainly played a part. But others believe that it was the very sound of the name, Quisling, that did it. The London Star of July 10, 1940, reported that the sound of Quisling conveyed all the odious, greasy wickedness of the man. So say it with me, Quisling. That does sound a bit greasy and odious now that you mention it, doesn't it? The London Times further ventured that Quisling also brought to mind other Q words with negative connotations, like quavering, quivering, and one of our target words from a previous lecture, querulous. Now, interestingly, while the term Quisling, meaning traitor, has lived on to this day, Quisling himself didn't last any longer than the war itself. With Norway's liberation at the end of World War II in 1945, Quisling was found guilty of treason and war crimes and was executed. It's amazing how being born with the wrong letter at the beginning of your name, Q, can get you into all sorts of linguistic trouble, huh? I'm glad my name's Flanagan. I think. Okay, for our next eponym, Bedlam. Bedlam is a noun referring to a place or situation of noisy uproar and confusion. This relatively short word took a fairly long journey, but one well worth learning about. Now, the story of Bedlam starts nearly 800 years ago, all the way back in England, in 1247, when Simon Fitzmary, former sheriff of London, founded the Priory of St. Mary of Bethlehem. And around 1330, this religious house was converted into the Hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem when it began helping the homeless and poor who were sick. Less than 100 years later, St. Mary of Bethlehem started admitting mental patients, the first institution in England to do so. And by the 16th century, it was converted into a state asylum for the insane. So, from religious house to hospital to insane asylum in approximately 300 years. Interesting, but where does the word bedlam fit into all this? Well, by at least the 1400s, the word Bethlehem and St. Mary of Bethlehem had been corrupted, or more specifically, telescoped into the word bedlam. While this may seem a bit strange, it's not an uncommon phenomenon with words. So say Bethlehem with me three times fast. Bethlehem, Bethlehem, Bedlam. You can see how this contraction of Bethlehem to Bedlam might happen in popular pronunciation. Now, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, an inmate of the Bethlehem Hospital during this time was referred to as a bedlam. This meaning for bedlam was later extended to refer to inmates of any lunatic asylum or just any person experiencing mental issues. Isn't it wonderful how elastic English is? Now get ready for this part. In the 1700s, it was not uncommon for members of the upper class to take a trip to St. Mary's to watch the mentally ill patients as a form of entertainment. In fact, some estimate that as many as 100,000 visitors per year came to watch for amusement. It seems like an earlier version of today's reality TV shows, doesn't it? It makes you wonder how little human behavior has changed throughout history. But in any case, you can imagine what a scene that must have been with all those unfortunate patients on display to the throngs of visitors. Wild, disorderly, full of commotion. And with that image in mind, you can also see how the term bedlam, which was initially used to refer to any madhouse, was extended to the more figurative current sense of a scene of noisy, mad confusion by the 1660s. Okay, we're going to dive into our next eponym, Luddite, with a game called You Just Might Be a Luddite If. So for this game, I'm going to ask you some questions. If you answer yes to any of them, you just might be a Luddite. Hey, ready? Here we go. First question. Have you ever gotten to work in the morning, turned on your computer, looked at the scores of emails clogging your inbox, and gotten an almost overpowering urge to chuck that laptop out the window and watch it crash to smithereens in the parking lot? And wished you could go back to a simpler time of the memo and the phone call? If so, you just might be a Luddite. Second question. Have you ever felt that you were just too connected with people on Facebook, FaceTime, LinkedIn, Twitter, and texting? Have you ever wanted to go back to a time when we actually talked to folks face to face? If so, you just might be a Luddite. Third question. Have you ever relied on your GPS on a long road trip, only to realize that it had taken you 2 hours out of your way, and then belatedly realized that a quick glance at an old-fashioned road map would have served you much better? So if you've ever felt any of these things, then you just might be a Luddite. A Luddite is a noun referring to anyone who opposes the introduction of technological change. We've probably all felt like a Luddite at certain times in our lives. Now, the original Luddites, with a capital L, were a group of English craftsmen who organized themselves into an activist workers' group in Midlands and Northern England in 1811. The Luddites feared that the introduction of new machinery would put them out of work. So they began destroying this machinery, operating from 1811 to 1816. The Luddites supposedly took their name from Ned Ludd. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, etymology for Luddite, Ned Ludd was a mentally unstable worker who, in a fit of insane rage, destroyed stocking frames in an English village. So, the Luddites took their name from Ludd, a noted destroyer of machines. Now, Luddite with a capital L has been used since 1811, the year the Luddites started smashing machinery, to refer to this group in history. However, Luddite with a lowercase L as a noun referring to anyone who opposes the introduction of new technology, is a relatively recent word, having taken on its current meaning by at least 1961. Now, what new technology was just starting to be introduced in the late 50s and early 60s that might have disgruntled some folks? You guessed it, computers. So an old term, Luddite, for an age-old feeling, resistance against progress, was now being used for a new specific purpose, resistance against computers. Pretty cool how English can resurrect old words, dust them off, and repurpose them as needed, isn't it? Kind of like taking your older brother's hand-me-down jeans, cutting them off, and using them as summer shorts. Now, Luddite was formed by taking the Lud from Ned Ludd and adding the suffix I-T-E, ite, a noun-forming suffix denoting, among other things, persons associated with a place, tribe, doctrine, or system, such as Israelite and Mennonite. So to remember Luddite, let's use the word-part connection strategy. Highlight the Lud part in Luddite. And when you see the Lud, I want you to think of the rhyming word dud, as in the word fuddy-duddy. So write the words fuddy-duddy in your vocabulary notebook next to Luddite. A Luddite might be a fuddy-duddy where technology is concerned, a person with old-fashioned and conservative ideas and attitudes. Our next eponym isn't really an eponym. It's actually a toponym, a word named after a place. But the story behind this word is just so good, I couldn't leave it out. That word is Billingsgate, a noun meaning foul, coarse, and abusive language. Now, when you think of salty, vulgar language, who do you think of? Sailors? Soldiers? Angry coaches? How about women who sell seafood? No? Well, this next story just might change your thinking. So let's start at the beginning. And for Billingsgate, the beginning was a gate, dating all the way back to the Roman occupation of Britain. Billingsgate, now one of London's 25 wards, originally was a water gate in the river wall on the north bank of the River Thames. And over the centuries, Billingsgate developed into a market and became especially well known for its fish market. However, the market also became well known for something besides fish: the vulgar, abusive, and coarse language that one heard while shopping. And in particular, it was the female fishmongers, in that era sometimes referred to as fishwives, who were notorious for their creative and biting profanity. As the Merriam-Webster New Book of Word History so vividly describes it, the fishmongers, especially the women, enjoyed a reputation for unrestrained invective that was wittily inventive, vulgarly explicit, and vigorously conveyed. How's that for a compliment? So just imagine yourself back in 18th century London, walking through Billingsgate shopping for fresh fish. As you work your way among the stalls, you're quietly amused by the profane repartee batted back and forth between the fishmongers and directed at the customers. And you might be enjoying it and taken aback by it, but all the while you're probably fearful of being caught in the verbal crosshairs yourself. So the fishwives of Billingsgate and the market itself became so well known for their obscene language that references to the place were not uncommon in English literature. For example, in William Thackeray's Vanity Fair. And the word became a true toponym when it began to be used as a general lowercase noun to describe particularly foul, coarse, and abusive language. Okay, let's use the word-part connection strategy to remember Billingsgate. So in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the gate in Billingsgate. And what do gates do? They keep things out or in when they're closed. So visualize a fishmonger with a wide-open mouth that looks like a gate, and visualize obscene language coming out of this open gate. And remember, the fishmongers of Billingsgate certainly didn't keep their gates closed when it came to speaking their mind. Now, as I like to do, I've saved one of my favorite eponyms for last, malapropism. You may not know what this word is at first, but I'm certain that you know the underlying concept, as you've definitely experienced malapropisms in your life. Malapropism is a noun referring to a ridiculous and often humorous misuse of words, particularly words that sound similar but are different in meaning. Here are a few malapropisms from yourdictionary.com. Former Boston Mayor Thomas Menino once said, "He was a man of great stature." Wes Westrum, calling a close baseball game that must have been thrilling right up to the very end, said, "Well, that was a cliff dweller." And Richard Daley, former mayor of Chicago, once said, "The police are not here to create disorder. They're here to preserve disorder." Now, some of my favorite malapropisms come from children. Richard Lederer, in his humorous book, Anguished English, has collected many examples. One student, referring to David from the Bible, said, "David had 300 wives and 700 porcupines." Another student reported that King Arthur lived in the age of chivalry. And a third reported that history calls people Romans because they never stayed in one place for very long. Now, we hear malapropisms come out of the mouths of children, celebrities, sports stars, and politicians, and even ourselves. Where did such a wonderful and useful word come from? Here's another memorable etymological narrative, or word history. Now, you've probably heard of the French phrase that we've borrowed in English, apropos, literally meaning to the purpose. Apropos means fitting, appropriate, pertinent. Apropos remarks are remarks that are appropriate and fit the occasion. Now, remember that prefix mal, meaning bad, evil, or ill? If we attach the prefix mal to apropos, we get a related word, malapropos, which means badly or ill-fitting, inappropriate. So if, while giving a wedding toast, you make disparaging remarks about the bride or groom, not something I recommend, your remarks would be considered malapropos. And a maladroit speaker often makes malapropos remarks. Now, the word malapropism came into our language from an 18th century English comedy, The Rivals, by Richard Brinsley Sheridan. And in this play, a character, Mrs. Malaprop, misuses words often to humorous effect. So, a malapropism is named after Mrs. Malaprop and is related to apropos. So be on the lookout for humorous misuses of words in your own life and jot them down under malapropism in your vocabulary notebook. So, in today's lecture, we've explored 8 wonderful eponyms, words named after people and places. We've heard stories of people and places whose names have come to refer to things as varied as facial hair, harsh laws, political flim-flamming, insane asylums, vulgar and salty language, and humorous misspeaking. Makes you think twice about wanting to have something named after you, doesn't it? So let's end with a quote about eponyms from one of my favorite comedians, Steve Martin, who said, "First, the doctor told me the good news. I was going to have a disease named after me." Not quite the eponym any of us would hope for, huh?
Lecture 18, Thinking, Teaching, and Learning Words.
According to the Greek historian Plutarch, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be kindled. Because the theme of today's lecture is thinking, teaching, and learning, I wanted to start off with one of my favorite quotes about education. And for me, this quote means that the best teachers don't simply lecture to students, expecting to pour knowledge into them as if they were empty buckets. Rather, excellent teaching is about actively engaging students to construct meaning in an inspiring way. Learning is active. So, I thought it appropriate to start today's lecture off with an activity that we've probably all participated in at some point in our lives. We're going to take a test, a sort of spelling bee, Flanagan style. Now, I can hear your groans already, but don't worry. You won't be graded, assessed, or evaluated. I promise. Now, I'm going to spell some words. After I spell each word, I'll say, you spell it. And at that point, I'll pause for a few seconds to give you time to simply try to spell the word out loud exactly as I spelled it. Now, don't try and read it as the whole word. Just spell it letter by letter, like I do. For example, I might say, our first word is spelled C-A-T. You spell it. Then you would simply say C-A-T. It's pretty straightforward. We'll start with an easy word and increase the difficulty until the fourth and final word. Okay, the first word is spelled D-O-G. You spell it. Did you get D-O-G, dog? Good. Now don't worry, they get harder. The second word is spelled R-E-D-U-N-D-A-N-T. Now you spell it. Did you get R-E-D-U-N-D-A-N-T? The third word. This one is a little more difficult, so listen closely. N-I-B-B-E-R-F-L-U-T-Z. Now you spell it. Did you spell it N-I-B-B-E-R-F-L-U-T-Z? Nibberfluts? Now don't worry, I'm not calling you something vile or horrible. Nibberfluts isn't a cuss word. In fact, Nibberfluts isn't a real word at all. It's a pseudo word, a nonsense word. I made it up. Now, educational researchers and cognitive psychologists interested in reading and literacy acquisition sometimes use pseudo-words like Nibberfluts to research how our minds recognize and process printed words. And some educators use pseudo-words to assess children's decoding ability as they're learning to read. Now, when I do a variation of this activity at presentations and workshops, most folks can spell Nibberfluts correctly, or nearly correctly, within a letter or two, even though they've never seen or heard the word before, because it's not a real word. Now, how can that be? That's an important point. Keep that in mind until we come to the end of the test. Okay, we're moving on to our last word to spell, another nonsense word. This one's the most difficult. You ready? The fourth word is spelled T-F-Z-L-B-N-R-B-I-U-E. Now you spell it. How'd you do on this last word? Did you get a bit frustrated? Was this last word the most difficult to spell? Now, here's the interesting thing. The last two words you spelled that I asked you to spell, Nibberfluts and what we're going to call the unpronounceable word, contain the exact same 11 letters. In other words, you've never seen either word before, and they both contain the exact same 11 letters, just in different sequences. So, my question to you is this. Why was Nibberfluts easier to remember and spell than the unpronounceable word? What principle of learning about words do you think we can conclude from this psycholinguistic experiment that we just conducted? The point I want to make is this. Our minds are not simply audio recorders, taking a recording of something and spitting it back out. If they were, you'd have been able to spell the third and fourth words just as easily. Our minds are better characterized as pattern detectors. When learning words and language, we look and listen for patterns that we already know. Patterns help us remember, store, and retrieve words. Patterns make learning easier and more efficient. Even though you'd never seen or heard Nibberfluts before, you were able to spell it, or come close, after hearing it only once because you recognize some familiar spelling patterns or chunks of letters in the word. The first syllable, nib, is similar to words like rib and bib. And you know the ER pattern in words like butter and river. And flutz is similar to a word you already have in your lexicon, klutz, an awkward person. So, instead of having to memorize 11 separate letters for nib or flutz, you actually only had to recognize 3 or 4 spelling patterns that you already knew. A much easier load on your memory. On the other hand, the unpronounceable fourth word was much more difficult to spell because it didn't contain any familiar, allowable spelling patterns in English for your mind to hold on to. Now, I started today's lecture with this spelling test activity for 2 reasons. First, it provides us another example of the power of patterns in word learning. That's why we focus so much on the patterns of our vocabulary system, affixes and roots, in this course. And second, I wanted to take you through a certain type of thinking process while you took our spelling test. In fact, our spelling test activity will help us differentiate between 2 commonly confused words that people use a lot when talking about thinking, teaching, and learning. Deduction and induction. Our first 2 target words for this lecture. Let's start with induction. Induction is a noun referring to the process of inferring general principles from individual facts or instances. So in other words, it's bottom-up reasoning. This is exactly what we did in our spelling activity a few minutes ago. From the individual instances of you attempting to spell those 4 words, we inferred a general principle of learning words. Our minds are pattern detectors, not audio recorders. So with induction, you go from the specific to the general, from the bottom up. Deduction is the opposite of induction. With deduction, it's top-down reasoning. You go from the general to the specific. Put more formally, deduction is a noun referring to the process of reasoning in which a conclusion necessarily follows from the stated premises. You may remember the following syllogistic argument as an example of deductive reasoning from that Philosophy 101 class that you took back in college. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So notice a couple of things going on here. First, you're moving from a general statement about humanity to the specific case of Socrates. And second, the conclusion necessarily follows from the premise. That's deduction. Now, you can remember deduction by highlighting the Latin prefix de and the root duc. De means down, from, or away. And duc is from the Latin word duco, which means to lead. Think aqueduct, something that leads water somewhere. So, a deduction leads one down from the general principles to the specific. Okay, let's move on from deduction and induction to exegesis, a word that refers to another type of thinking process. Now, when I think of exegesis, I think back to one of the first classes I took in grad school. The class was on literacy acquisition, a really tough class. And one of our assignments was to read and analyze an article on the causes and consequences of dyslexia. Now, this particular article was written by one of the big guns in our field and was extremely scholarly. The article presupposed a fair amount of knowledge that my fellow students and I didn't have at the time, and we all struggled to comprehend it. In fact, we were pretty anxious that our professor would find us out in the next class. But thankfully, during our seminar the next week, our professor confessed that he knew that we'd struggle with the article. He wanted to challenge us. After getting a sense of our understanding of the article, he delivered an incredibly clear and elegant explanation of the major concepts and understandings in the manuscript. Not only did he explain the parts we didn't understand, he connected it to our own experiences and even clarified our prior misconceptions. I can still remember that explanation to this day. A light bulb came on, a veil was lifted from my eyes, and the angel started singing. Eureka! I understood. My professor's exegesis of that article made all the difference in our understanding. Exegesis, our next target word, is a noun that refers to an explanation or critical interpretation, especially of the Bible or another religious text. Now, the word exegesis is a transliteration of a Greek word meaning explanation, interpretation. To remember exegesis, think of a time you've read something that was particularly difficult and someone helped you make sense of it. Perhaps it was a teacher, a classmate in a study group, or a colleague at your work. Or maybe you were explaining the meaning of a Bible verse or a poem to someone. That's exegesis. For our next target word related to thinking, let's go back to the 1950s, when behaviorism dominated the social sciences. Now, popularized by the writings of psychologists John B. Watson and B.F. Skinner, behaviorism argued that all behavior, including language, could be explained by a few laws of stimulus and response. However, Noam Chomsky, now widely recognized as the father of modern linguistics, but a relatively young unknown linguist at the time, wasn't having it. He saw holes in behaviorism that others didn't see, and revolutionized the field of linguistics by famously critiquing Skinner's book, Verbal Behavior. Now, as described by Steven Pinker in his excellent book, The Language Instinct, Chomsky's critique of behaviorism was twofold. Now, to understand Chomsky's first critique, listen to this silly sentence, which I made up just for this lecture, and that I am sure no one has ever uttered before in the history of the human race. Okay, ready? Here we go. The Flanagan family loves to invite pink crocodiles over for dinner on Friday nights to watch movies, eat lightly buttered popcorn, and discuss the history and politics of Ireland. Now, behaviorists would have us believe that language is simply a collection of responses that we learn, simply us repeating what we've heard from others. But if that's the case, how could I come up with that completely novel sentence like that, and how could you understand it? Now, second, Chomsky brought up examples of children's grammatical errors as they're acquiring oral language. If you've ever been around young children talking, you've heard these wonderful linguistic constructions like, "I win the game, Daddy." Or one I've heard quite a bit with three kids, "He hitted me." Now, if children were just imitating their parents, they would have said, "I won the game, Daddy," not, "I win the game, Daddy." So why don't they? Because, according to Chomsky, children are little linguists with an innate instinct for language and the ability to generate rules. In the hitted example above, the child tacitly figured out that to create the past tense of a verb, you need to add ed in word pairs like jump, jumped, and hop, hopped. It's not this child's fault that the past tense of win happens to be irregular, won rather than wind. So Chomsky was far too perspicacious to be taken in by behaviorism's claims. Perspicacious, our next target word, is an adjective that means having or showing keen mental perception. Perspicacious people are shrewd. They have penetrating mental discernment. If you're perspicacious, you're discerning and astute. Like Chomsky, you can perceive things that others might miss. Now, synonyms and related words for perspicacious include acute, astute, discerning, penetrating, and two wonderful ones, sagacious and sapient. Now, perspicacious comes from the Latin prefix per, meaning through, and a Latin root we've already explored, spec or spic, which means look. So, if you're perspicacious, you have the ability to look through the surface of things. You can detect things that others might miss. It's kind of like an intellectual version of X-ray vision. If you remember perspicacious this way, you won't forget it. So highlight the PER and SPIC and write their meanings in your vocabulary notebook. Okay, for our fifth target word, I point to myself. Now, I've been a teacher for much of my life. I got into education because I love to instruct, to demonstrate, to try and inspire others to learn. I'm the one on our family trips who's constantly stopping the van to point out historical landmarks to our children, quizzing them on the state's capitals, and asking them which characters in the books they're reading they'd most like to be, and why. However, my own children tell me that I overdo this teacher thing at times. And probably my worst habit in this regard is constantly pausing movies we're watching to replay a line I love. Or to point out something like, hey look, there's the Empire State Building in that scene. Do you guys remember that trip? Who remembers how high it is? When was it built? Raise your hand if you like the Empire State Building better than the Chrysler Building. So when I hit the pause button, groans, eye rolling, and cries of, Dad, ensue. So now, before we start a movie, my kids will launch a preemptive strike, getting hold of the remote control before I can, so that I'm powerless to try and teach them anything, and they can simply enjoy the movie. I mean, what fun is that? So, I'm ashamed to say that these are true examples of me being more than a bit didactic, our next target word. Didactic is an adjective that means inclined to teach or moralize excessively. If someone or something like a book is didactic, it's preachy and excessively instructive. Didactic lectures are boring, long on lecture, short on interest. Let's put didactic in context. Although the movie contained a powerful lesson, it wasn't overly didactic. Synonyms for didactic include preachy and donnish. Sermonize is an underused verb that I love for someone who's talking in a didactic manner. If a professor or teacher you know is going on and on, perhaps trying too hard to teach you a lesson, talking to you rather than with you, you can say, there goes Flanagan, sermonizing again. Now another synonym for didactic is pedantic. However, there's a slight difference in meaning. Pedantic is an adjective that means characterized by a narrow, often ostentatious concern for book learning and formal rules. If you know someone who constantly loves showing off their knowledge of trivial details and obscure facts, they're pedantic. So, didactic and pedantic are both negative adjectives you can use for teachers and teaching. Didactic emphasizes excessive teaching. Pedantic emphasizes excessive attention to trivia, often to show off. And by the way, pedantic comes from the Greek root PED, meaning child, in derived words like pedagogy and pediatrician. Don't confuse this with the Latin root also spelled PED, meaning foot, in words like pedal, pedestal, pedicure, centipede, and pedestrian. All right, for our next target word, imagine this. You're away at college living in a dorm room, and a bunch of the guys in the suite across the hall are constantly partying and blaring music at all hours. You've tried to get them to engage in a little intellectual conversation, but they're not going for it. In fact, one of them just laughed when you asked him to join your study group. It seems that all they want to do is hang out, eat pizza, and stay up late playing video games. Well, there's a sophisticated word for these unsophisticated barbarians. Philistines. Philistine is a noun referring to a person who is uninterested in intellectual pursuits and indifferent or hostile to artistic and cultural values. Now, Philistine is a rich vocabulary word with a wonderful history going back to biblical times. And the following word history is based on the excellent account in the Merriam-Webster New Book of Word Histories. The original Philistines were the inhabitants of the southern coast of ancient Palestine. Enemies of the Israelites, the Philistines were known for being aggressive and crude. And since the 1600s, the word Philistine has been used to refer humorously to enemies, into whose hands one might fall. However, the modern meaning of Philistine as a boorish person seems to have originated in the German town of Jena in 1687. A town versus gown confrontation between the people of Jena and the students in the local university led to several deaths. So in response, a local clergyman delivered a sermon to the townspeople on the value of education and quoted a passage from the book of Judges. "The Philistines be upon thee, Samson." So the university students took the sermon and ran with it, using the German word for Philistine, Philister, to refer to those ignorant townspeople who were opposed to education. But it was Matthew Arnold, an English poet and critic, who took the final step, translated the German Philister to Philistine, and used the word in his book, Culture and Anarchy. And since the book's publication in 1869, Philistine, carrying its current meaning, has been used widely by English authors.